Alors bonjour, bonsoir. J'ai le plaisir de vous présenter la troisième séance du TM Forum Contemporain et Environnement. Juste, je me présente brièvement moi. Je m'appelle Rainer Kazig, je suis géographe allemand et chercheur au Cresson à Grenoble. Cette dernière séance de notre première journée se composait heureusement seulement de deux interventions, la conférence de Martin Seel sur ma droite et une performance de Joan Clavel qui se trouve là, à gauche. Si cette conférence avait eu lieu en Allemagne, il ne serait pas nécessaire de passer beaucoup de temps à une présentation de Martin Seel. Parce qu'il fait partie des philosophes, ou encore mieux exprimé, des intellectuels qui sont lus et connus largement en dehors de leur propre discipline. Martin Seel est philosophe, depuis 1992 professeur de philosophie et travaille à l'Institut de philosophie de l'Université de Francfort. L'Institut a enseigné où ont enseigné plusieurs membres de la fameuse école de Francfort. Si on suit des indications de son site internet, ses champs de travail sont la philosophie théorique, la philosophie pratique et l'esthétique. Et il me semble que dans le cadre de notre conférence, ce sont avant tout ses travaux en esthétique qui nous touchent et dont je vais vous parler peut-être pendant une minute. Ces deux monographies, l'esthétique de la nature, publiée en 1991, et l'esthétique de l'apparaître, publiée en 2000 et traduite en anglais, espagnol et polonais, sont, au moins selon ma compréhension, au centre de ses réflexions sur l'esthétique. Dans les deux livres, Martin Seel développe une approche esthétique de l'ordinaire. La perception esthétique, qu'il comprend comme une forme spécifique de rapport sensible au monde, est au centre de son approche. Il propose une déclination de cette perception esthétique et distingue trois modalités de l'apparition esthétique de l'ordinaire. Ces trois modalités se distinguent par la forme des imaginations et réflexions qui accompagnent la perception esthétique. La contemplation ou l'apparition pure, donc la première forme, est caractérisée par une absence de réflexion. L'apparition esthétique atmosphérique, par des références à des propres ou des possibles formes de vie, et l'apparition esthétique par des références à l'art. Pendant que Martin Seel se sert de cette approche dans l'esthétique de la nature pour discuter sous un nouveau angle la question pourquoi et comment les hommes prennent plaisir de la nature, il développe de manière plus générale son approche dans le deuxième livre, l'esthétique de l'apparaître. Les travaux de Martin Seel ne se limitent bien évidemment pas à ce que je viens d'évoquer. La discussion de rapport entre éthique et esthétique, et plus récemment l'esthétique du film, y occupe également une place importante, sans parler de ses contributions dans les deux autres champs. Martin Seel est également un philosophe qui est présent en dehors du discours proprement académique et a écrit régulièrement dans le journal hebdomadaire Die Zeit et occasionnellement dans les grands journaux quotidiens germanophones. La deuxième intervenante, maintenant plus bas, de cette saison, Joan Clavel, un double parcours qui m'a beaucoup impressionné, scientifique et artiste. En plus, Joan Clavel a développé sa carrière scientifique entre la France et les États-Unis. Elle a un master en art et performance et un doctorat en écologie et évolution obtenu à Paris. Son parcours est complété à Berkeley par des études en écologie politique et éthique environnementale. Dans la continuité de cette formation, elle travaille aujourd'hui, entre autres, donc elle a plusieurs activités, comme j'ai compris, comme chercheur au Muséum national d'histoire naturelle. Sur son côté artistique, Joan Clavel a une formation de danse classique et contemporain et en flûte. Basée sur ce double parcours comme scientifique et artiste, elle a fondé en 2008 le collectif d'artistes Natural Movement qui propose des co-constructions art et sciences en rassemblant universitaires et artistes. Au centre des préoccupations de ces collectifs sont les relations hommes, nature, société, tout au pluriel. Le développement d'une culture écologique est une des motivations principales du collectif Natural Movement. Il développe ainsi des ateliers pédagogiques, des documentaires, des vidéos d'art et des spectacles vivants. La performance, ou un petit peu la présentation d'une performance, parce qu'il n'y a malheureusement pas la possibilité de la déplacer dans l'autre salle, qu'elle nous propose ce soir s'inscrit dans cette logique. Intitulée Tree Sitters, donc les gens qui sont assis sur les arbres, elle nous amène dans le monde des éco-activistes qui vivent dans les arbres pour les protéger contre la destruction. Mais avant que nous participions à sa performance, je passe la parole à Martin Seel pour sa conférence « Landscapes of Human Experience ». Et je nous souhaite une séance riche et inspirante qui met en résonance science et art.
Merci beaucoup. Good evening, everybody. It has been a long day for all of us, and unfortunately, the last talk now will be once again in English. I'm very sorry for this, but I can't do otherwise. But the relief, again, for all of us is that afterwards there will be something to be seen and not so much talking, I suppose. Okay, and I would like cordially to thank Nathalie Blanc and Jean-Marie Schaeffer for kindly inviting me. And let's go. There will be no slides, just words. So another sad information. My lecture will begin with some observations concerning the interaction between nature and art. And relying on these reflections, in the second part, I will interpret the experience of landscape as a model for the human stance within the natural as well as the historical world. In the third part, I shall draw some consequences for an ethics and politics of saving the conditions of individual as well as social well-being. Well, let's begin with nature. A main source of experiencing and reflecting the delicate balances between human nature and nature in general have always been and still are the complex interrelations between art and nature. Let me therefore begin with a slightly altered first half of the first sentence of Adorno's aesthetic theory, slightly altered. It has become self-evident that nothing which concerns nature is any longer self-evident. For a long time, or at least a quite long time now, popular awareness has realized that we are living in an era of increasingly frequent and severe ecological crisis. But this awareness has a particular characteristic. With each menacing report, it flames up anew, only soon thereafter to subside back into restless dozing. Yet there are more than enough disquieting circumstances which would be suitable for taking an unblinking look at the uncertain future of human as well as non-human nature. The most sobering and obdurate fact is that nature cannot be destroyed. Human beings are not the center, crown, or guarantor of nature. They may nourish or exploit it, but they cannot take over its direction. If mankind were to fully destroy its living conditions, what would remain would be nature, which wins every competition with it. A second concomitant fact is that alterations in nature belong to its very nature. The developments of industrial culture bring about changes in these alterations, accelerating them or imparting another direction to them, but they remain subject to its, that is, nature's dynamic. We are a factor in the history of nature, even where we set out to modify our genetic program. The third fact consists of the recognition that under current conditions, local effects have a global impact in many cases. The emissions increasing throughout the world, the melting of the polar ice caps, the flooding of coastal areas, the wasteful use of water, the pollution of the oceans, the cutting down of atrophying forests, the erosion of soil, all these factors add up to an alteration of the landscape which no nation state can slow down on its own, not to speak of offering a cure. Social, political, and military confrontations over the distribution of land, air, and resources are the foreseeable consequence. The politics of nature have become the domestic politics of the world. That is, they have become a matter of global justice. A fourth irritating circumstance consists of the fact that the appearances of nature often continue to maintain their aesthetic fascination there where their impact has become threatening. Our sensory grasp is unable, or might be unable, to measure sufficiently the quality of external nature. It could be that we perish in a spectacle of cruel beauty. This records the fifth and, from a practical point of view, pivotal fact that there does not exist an objective, solely decisive indicator with regard to the treatment of nature. Our relationship to outer and inner nature is dependent upon a complex consideration of what we intend to undertake with our knowledge about the condition of the earth, and accordingly how the further shaping of the human life form is supposed to look. Clear-sighted politics with regard to nature will have to be concerned less with physical nature, in spite of the importance of the investigation which provide us with information about the ecology of the planet. The challenge lies much more in the protection of a physiological nature, which sustains our own bodily organism just as it does those of animal and vegetable life forms, with which we are required to live in symbiosis and synergy for good or evil. Because the conditions of our life is at stake, it is not only our life which is at stake. The nature on which this depends is not an object which we can dominate to a greater or lesser extent, not a counterpart to which we can more or less correspond, not even an environment in which we have allowed much to become wrecked and with which we are now desperately trying to repair, but instead the global space in which cultures and societies will remain capable of development or will stiffen in agony. For this space, humanity, represented above all by the rich industrial nations, has a responsibility which is presently, as you know, failing to meet. It is failing to meet it because it manages its economics without giving consideration to losses. The protection of nature is a protection from ourselves, seen in that way. It's a protection from ourselves for the sake of ourselves, from the neglect and dissipation with which we disregard our own living sphere. But what do these uncomfortable reminders have to do with art, as indicated in my opening statement? A great deal, because they have to do with its discomforting powers. There were especially some of the more recent visual arts concerned themselves with the phenomena of nature. They fathomed the manifold disturbances of the modern relationship to and understanding of nature by means of unsettling presentations. Art here experiments with its forms in order to investigate those of nature. It establishes references to nature while being constantly overcome by doubt as to what it is in fact referring to. It has become self-evident that nothing concerning art is any longer self-evident. This is, as you know, the original first half of the first sentence in Adorno's aesthetic theory. These two sentences, however, the original and my alteration, in my view, belong together. That they are interrelated, however, still is far from being self-evident. From antiquity well into modern times, thinking about the interconnection between nature and art was defined by hierarchical concepts. First, nature was the model, then it became a replica of art. If one wanted to summarize this very long and complex history in one single sentence, it could be this one. Only recently, this hierarchical mode of thinking began to fade. Since the final third of the 20th century, the inner yet always delicate and dynamic complicity between art and nature was more and more recognized. Impelled by the diverse developments in artistic production and accompanied by an increasingly sensitive theoretical reflection. However, the classical formulation of the reciprocal relationship between aesthetic nature and art was already found quite some time earlier. In paragraph 45 of his Critique of the Power of Judgment from 1790, Immanuel Kant wrote, I quote, "Nature was beautiful when it simultaneously resembled art. And art can be only deemed to be beautiful when we are aware of the fact that it is art and yet appears to us like nature." End of quote. What Kant is concerned with here, already back then, is the resolution of the question as to which serves as the model for aesthetic perception and production, free nature or free art. Kant's solution lies, in the thesis of a double exemplariness of nature for art and of art for nature. The presence of aesthetically perceived nature is a model for the inner vitality of the work of art. The imagination of the work of art, on the other hand, is at least one model for an intensive perception of nature. One of three models in my theory, there are three constitutive dimensions for the aesthetic appreciation of nature. Rainer Kanzig was so friendly to mention at least the other ones, but I leave them aside because this is another too long story. The reciprocal fecundation of art and aesthetic nature arises only when nature, among other things, can be perceived as successful art, and when art, among other things, can be perceived as free nature, without the difference between art and nature being extinguished. It is neither nature perceived in the appearance of art, nor art perceived in the appearance of nature, which Kant established as a norm of an unrestrained aesthetic consciousness, but rather a dialogue between art and nature. This, of course, is always our dialogue. Nature doesn't speak to us, if it speaks. It is accomplished in both the production and the reception of art as soon as we begin to sense how little self-evident our own nature actually is to us. This was the first part. In the diversity of their genres and forms, especially the visual arts, give rise to quite different reactions to our reactions with regard to nature. Whether we think of painting, photography, sculpture, film, or video, however much these genres might make subliminal or overt deals with each other, or whether it is installations which integrate many of them into their own structures, they all allow themselves to become easy at the uncertain and vulnerable relationship which is maintained by contemporary societies and cultures to the natural aspect or dimension of their existence. That which impels the encounter between art and its counterpart is accordingly both the individual and the collective self-relationship of contemporary mankind, which, at every random corner of the world, and in the contemplation of each individual artificial or untreated object, knows itself to be situated in the middle of a global play of comprehensive social and natural forces. Where artistic shaping stages this play of forces in one way or another, it uses its techniques to investigate the landscape character of our relationships to nature. Aspects of the circumstances that, in our various activities, we move within realms of which we know that they constantly exceed the horizon of our perceptual capabilities. In the classical conception, landscape is that zone which brings the culmination of the experience of natural beauty. But the experience of landscape is in no way limited to natural settings, which are predominantly untouched or staged in the manner of parks. It can open frequently to an envisioning of domesticated and urban districts. In any case, we should remind ourselves that almost all landscape today, even those on the fringes of civilization, are never purely nature, but always also, even if to quite different degrees, alloys of nature and culture. At the same time, however, the structure of every landscape, even of those in the space of a large city, is always a state and event of nature. Each one, however it may be marked and altered by the works of mankind, offers to the aesthetic sense an essentially unguided play of abundance and transformation, just as in predominantly untouched nature. This is why in my book, Aesthetics of Nature, I bluntly said that nature is the nature of landscape. It is precisely this reciprocal fecundation of nature by culture and of culture by nature in the configuration of landscape areas which allows to conceive the experience of them, that is, of landscapes, into a theoretical model of not only the dialogue between nature and art, but also for the interaction between natural and human flourishing in general. The space of a landscape exists, like almost every space, together with a variety of objects in this space. What is fundamental for the experience of a space as landscape, however, is not the phenomenal encounter of individual or multiple objects, but instead the experience of being under and amid all of these objects, or to put it even more boldly, to be an object under and amid, us being an object, objects under and amid of all these objects. In their proximity and distance, in their constricting or liberating, eloquent or dumb presence. Whoever finds him or herself to be within such an abundance of appearances, for her or him, there is no middle from which a fixed order of these appearings could be discerned. The space of the landscape surrounds the perceiving persons. It reshapes their location. Therefore, perceivers are in no way observers in command of a panoramatic overview, which, on the contrary, is a common form of blindness to landscapes. Instead, they, the perceivers, are bodily subjects who sense themselves to be receptive and vulnerable beings in mid a spatial occurrence. Thus, the perception of landscape is not solely the experience of the existent and transformation of many things in this space. It is the experience of an happening space, the experience of what it is to be under and amid a multiform appearing of spatial shapes. This occurrence, to be sure, can only take place in a more or less extensive space. Its reality begins there where space steps out of its dimension, in the sense that its measurements cannot be comprehended by those who find themselves within it. The space of a landscape has neither edge or border, it ends in a horizon. There, where the contours, forms, and delineations become diffuse, or there, where, in the case of a labyrinthic city, it palpably extends further without it being possible to comprehend these extensions from one's own standpoint. Landscapes are thus spaces that can neither be surveyed or covered. In the shiftings of their horizons, they go past our horizon. It is only within this vertical and horizontal incompleteness that the space of a landscape opens up. This incompleteness always implies an openness on the side of subjects who conduct themselves in a certain manner with regard to the space of their surroundings. Ultimately, the entire sense of entering landscapes in a mode of aesthetic awareness lies in the fact that in them we arrive outside, into a simultaneously real and metaphorical outside. This outside is real because we depart from our own four walls, in fact, from all clear and straightforward spatial coordinates. However, this is only a necessary, but in itself not a sufficient precondition for the experience of landscape as landscape. For an expansive space extending in all directions is, in its own terms, simply a potential site for the aesthetic awareness of a given landscape. There only occurs an actual experience of landscape when, in the real exterior, we also attain a metaphorical exterior. When we loosen the attachment to the pragmatic orientations which define our normal behavior in space. When we no longer move through the space with specified goals, but instead maintain an openness for the irregular presence of that extensive space itself. However we attempt to make such presences possible through forms of architecture and of the design and preservation of landscapes in city and nature, the process of its presence exceeds all acts of making. In the experience of landscapes, in other words, wherever it may occur, there resonates a feeling to the connectedness with nature in all cultural practice, in all social organization, and with it in all technology. Inherent to this experience is at least a seed of the affirmation of the borders of all culture and thereby at least a trace of ecological humility. For however limited periods of time, it ushers us out of our imprisonment within the conviction that, for the sake of our welfare, we ought to be more and more able to dominate our inner and outer nature. Even where its counterpart is not primarily a natural landscape, it guides us into the open dimension of our nature-bound historical world. The interaction between art and nature here once again becomes evident. Just as in the unchained experience of landscape, the arts confront us with the fact that our farsightedness, no matter how extensive, succumbs to a blurriness which is only the flip side of our clarity. Art diffuses an overview most emphatically there where we deem ourselves to have a full view. It entices us to peer into the clair obscur of our knowledge. It endeavors to awaken us from the dogmatic slumber with which the comfort of the industrialized world repeatedly lulls its prosperous inhabitants. Along the path of a disturbance of our worldviews, it interrupts all self-certain handling of the difference between nature and culture. Not only nature proceeds past our horizon, art well can transcend it. In the best cases, it allows us to see our own blindness. Blindness. I come to my last part, which is shorter than the previous ones. These observations lead to the point where the model of landscape achieves its ethical and political relevance. The aesthetic attraction of landscapes and paradigmatically those of nature unfold and deploy a contingent life of ever-changing forms, a contingent life of forms, which in their synesthetic simultaneity and succession enable those who encounter them a unique mode of freedom. Not only the wastelands, but other landscapes as well, I would like to hold. Especially within the realm of nature, a permanent process of evolving and dissolving, appearing and disappearing takes place. Here it becomes possible to loosen our personal and cultural fixations and obsessions. Here it becomes possible to step in a non-instrumental relation to our environment. Here it becomes possible to voluntarily let ourselves be captured by what we cannot sensibly wish to capture. This, on the one hand, implies an affirmative awareness of the limits of our mastery of ourselves and the world. This experience, on the other hand, reminds us of what it means to be a temporary inhabitant in a natural, cultural, social, and historical world. Moreover, this encounter can serve as a paradigmatic scene for what non-destructive prosperity of human societies would mean, namely to live in a political environment in which natural as well as human flourishing would be welcome. From this sketch, a number of ethical and political consequences can be drawn. The first, still primarily aesthetic moral, lies in the very appreciation of the processes of natural unfolding itself, traditionally praised as the realm of natural beauty. However, we should avoid any restrictive understanding of the term beauty here. To experience the world in clear proportion or in clear disproportion to one's own possibilities, not this is what is truly compelling, but rather to be aware of the disharmonious in the harmonious and the harmonious in the disharmonious. Beauty which soothes without irritation is none. Sublimity which unsettles without liberating cannot be elevated. Therefore, natural beauty as well should be conceived of along the lines offered by the model of the experience of landscape. The second moral arises from the assumption that in the existence of eras of more or less vivid natural environments, there lies a genuine possibility of human self-exploration. What follows here is what I would like to call a general pragmatic rule for individual and collective life conduct. Regardless of how one might otherwise live, the conscious encounter with zones of more or less contingent natural growing is valuable for all, as it frees one in relation to one's own form of life. As an indispensable corrective of individual and collective orientations or ideals, natural beauty constitutes a specific dimension of human well-being. The third, now strictly moral and political consequence, follows almost directly from this much weaker perspective. If a prospering nature establishes a genuine occasion of human well-being, then the preservation of this condition is part of the general respect for persons. Thus, the protection and recreation of spaces of vivid natural development becomes a norm of universal morality. The ethics of nature, therefore, does not need to presuppose a right of nature vis-à-vis humanity in order to justify a strong obligation to protect the environment. More modestly, it can simply assert the right to have access to more or less undistorted nature is one among the human rights, and it implies duties towards other living beings as well. The meaning of this right and its corresponding duties becomes clearer when we finally consider the consequences of its violation. Here, the moral and political scandal lies not so much or not only in the destruction of a necessary precondition of bearable life at all, but rather in the destruction of a universal form of flourishing human existence. The destruction or preclusion of natural beauty liquidates non-instrumental relations with nature within the human life world. As such, it leads to a destruction of positive contingency, realized freedom, and fulfilled time. It is the destruction of a special and irreplaceable domain of the human world. Just as there is no life for humanity without nature as a regenerative means of subsistence, and no at least bearable life without physiological nature as an intact environment of human as well as non-human being, so too the quality of human life is greatly impoverished without areas of an accommodating nature. Thank you very much for your patience.
So thank you very much. The floor is open for questions. Martin, I don't know how we have to deal with this. I think we can try to make it in English. I don't know if there's a simultaneous traduction from English to French.
No.
That's the first one.
Thank you for this talk. Indeed intense at the end of this day. I marked down the sentence you said, the protection of nature is in fact also a protection from ourselves, for the sake of ourselves. And it made me think of something that people talk about, that this what we tend to call environmental crisis, which is of course just a term, is perhaps a crisis of consciousness also. And I'm linking that to, you were talking about inner and outer nature. I'm very interested in the notion of inner landscape. And also, I'm wondering if maybe one of the things to do, I'm interested in what we can do, could be to reconnect with this inner landscape. And because I really liked your description of what it's like to be in a landscape, in and amid these abundance of things of different appearance, but is this appreciation of nature, is that something we can improve by improving our appreciation of ourselves, is perhaps my question.
Yeah, thank you very much. You pointed to a topic I didn't go into. I mentioned, I think, twice inner nature, but I didn't talk about inner nature, only indirectly when I tried to give an explication of the effect of experiencing landscapes aesthetically, that is a questioning of our self-understanding and a sort of leaving behind the interpreted world, die gedeutete Welt, as Rilke says in one of his poems. So leaving behind our fixed set of beliefs, or fixed plans, life plans. Being in nature is always a questioning of life plans. If you don't, landscape. Again, landscapes exist independent in a certain sense. Of course, I didn't go into that. They exist independent of how we act towards them. When I was talking about landscape being conceived as landscape, I tried to describe a certain approach to landscapes. And in this way, always our self-understanding is on the fore when we talk about aesthetics of landscape. And I found the notion of inner landscape attractive. You offered to me. I didn't use it. I've never used it. But it would be another metaphorical dimension, so to speak, of what it means to experience landscapes in their openness and uncontrollability. And the inner landscape, I think, there are analogies. The inner landscape, nobody overviews his inner landscapes. We don't have no overview, and not only literally, but even metaphorically, we don't have an overview, and we sort of wait, there are waves to move within your inner landscapes, and an inner landscape of a person. If I try to improvise on this metaphor, there are strong tensions as well as in the geology of real landscape. So this would be maybe the next talk, maybe your next talk on this topic. My talk sort of asked for being complemented by an artistic performance, and I think everybody's looking forward to the next item, and maybe just leave it like that. Okay.
Thank you very much again for the call.
Alors, juste pour dire deux mots sur ce que vous allez voir maintenant. Donc, il va vous manquer évidemment toute la partie chorégraphique et dansée, qui est peut-être la partie la plus importante de la performance. Cependant, c'est quand même une histoire et un message que j'avais envie de passer. Donc, il en reste un petit peu grâce à ces traces, qui remémorent un événement qui a eu à Berkeley il y a quelques années, et d'une manière générale, qui tente de documenter les formes créatives, on va dire, que mettent en place les activistes. Donc ici, il s'agit de vivre avec les arbres pour les protéger. L'hypothèse qui est faite, c'est que les bûcherons ne couperont pas les arbres ou sur lesquels il y a des hommes dessus. Alors on va voir avec l'histoire qui est racontée qu'il y a d'autres manières de les enlever. Et le premier tweesitter était en Nouvelle-Zélande et son combat a mené à la protection d'une aire protégée, enfin à la protection d'une aire naturelle. Par la suite, il y en a eu beaucoup d'autres qui n'ont pas d'issue aussi positive. Et notamment au nord de la Californie, il y a une figure, on va dire, des tweesitters, Julia Butterfly, qui a vécu pendant plus d'un an sur un séquoia, Luna, son séquoia s'appelait Luna. Alors évidemment, vivre plus d'un an sur un arbre, ça demande toute une organisation autour. Et dans son cas, elle, ça a mené à la destruction du patch de séquoia qu'elle protégeait. Donc voilà, il n'y a pas toujours des issues favorables, en tout cas pour la nature. Ici, c'est un cas donc ponctuel. Il se trouve que j'ai eu l'occasion d'habiter dans ce lieu-là. Et je voulais juste dire un petit mot. Donc, j'ai habité à Berkeley et c'est une histoire sur le campus universitaire qui est relatée. Une dernière chose, c'est que vous allez voir des personnes, des non-danseurs qui ont participé à une performance. Donc, il y a eu une captation de ces performances-là. Une fois que j'avais fait tout un travail de documentation un peu historique sur ce qui s'était passé, j'ai lancé en fait au département d'écologie qui voulait participer pour une performance qui a donc eu lieu quatre fois, quatre après-midi, deux fois dans les arbres et deux fois sur les arbres qui étaient absents. Et donc ils ont suivi une partition, je travaille pas mal avec la méthode RSVP des Halprin, si ça dit quelque chose aux gens. Et du coup, c'était un peu ça, ce processus de création qu'on a mis en place avec ces gens que je ne connaissais pas, donc, qui sont venus participer à ce travail avec moi.
I remember there was like a city or a little group of people that were sitting in the trees because I think the school wanted to cut them down because of the football stadium being renovated or something like that.
This was like a few years ago on campus. I remember there being a lot of helicopters around campus at the time because it was a big news story.
And they were historic oak trees, and so people lived in the trees for like several weeks.
They are about 80 years old, they were. They're the California native oak, coastline oak. So they organized, and first they tried, of course, through all the proper bureaucratic ways to stop it. And then because that didn't work, they decided to climb the trees and sit in the trees.
For environmental reasons and also for cultural reasons, because this is a sacred site for the Ohlone Native Americans that used to live in the more widespread in this area.
Some of them were older women.
Sylvia McLaughlin, who was in her 90s. And she's one of the founders of the Save the Bay organization, and she climbed up and sat in the tree.
There was a lot of young people, too. I remember somebody was interviewed who only went by the name Dumpster Muffin, which I loved that was her nickname.
Largely, the students were against it. Like, the community in Berkeley was either ignoring it or against it. And I think it ended with basically the university bringing the firefighters and just by blasting them with water.
I think I was one of the tree centers, and they wanted to cut down a grove of trees, and we thought the trees were very beautiful, and we didn't want them to cut them down.
It seems kind of silly to me, personally. I think there's a lot more effective ways to protest than sitting in a tree.
The situation would have to be extreme to drive me to be wanting to sit in a tree and feeling it's really important to sit in the tree.
In this case, I'm for the tree sit here because I think they want to renovate the stadium, but there are better ways to do it without involving the trees.
I'm not a fetishist of trees. If there was like a real big need to actually cut them down and build something, I think that would make sense. But you should include in this decision people who care about the environment, the community living around. Also, if the tribe has official claims that this is a sacred ground and they should at least co-decide.
I've just been very interested in keeping things as natural as possible.
What's gone is gone, what's been saved is saved. And I think it made some difference, I'd like to think.
De RSVP, c'est ça? Ouais. Alors, c'est une méthode qui propose en fait d'arriver avec des ressources, de faire participer du coup un public et de performer ces ressources mises en commun. Une fois qu'on a travaillé là-dessus, on évalue le résultat pour recommencer un cycle pour améliorer à chaque fois le processus de co-création qu'on est en train de faire. Donc là, la ressource, c'était évidemment cette histoire. Et on était sur les lieux mêmes, en fait. Donc au départ, on voit les résistants, les chaînes qui restent. Et puis à la fin, on est vraiment sur tout ce qui a été rasé et rénové, donc le stade. Et puis, on a travaillé sur la chute, je pense que ça se voit pas mal. On a travaillé au départ dans les arbres, qu'est-ce que c'est que vivre dans les arbres, se réveiller avec les arbres, manger sur un arbre, écouter le son de l'arbre. Donc voilà, imaginer un peu ce que ça peut être. Et puis après, au contraire, travailler sur tout ce qui était la violence, que c'est tout simplement de détruire des arbres, mais aussi... Dans les témoignages que j'avais reçus, il y avait vraiment beaucoup de gens qui riverains qui utilisaient ce patch pour leur promenade, pour des choses tout simplement très quotidiennes, mais qui faisaient qu'ils étaient attachés à cet endroit-là. Donc voilà, essayer de mettre en geste et de mettre aussi en geste des gens qui n'avaient pas du tout l'habitude de travailler et de danser. Alors là, bon, évidemment, la vidéo, ça fait des gros creux un peu. Désolée.
Encore des questions? Donc, s'il y en a, si j'en vois plus, donc encore un merci à Joanne Claval et Martin Zill pour les contributions pour cette séance. Et je vous souhaite merci pour votre patience de rester jusqu'à maintenant 7 heures. Donc, je vous souhaite une très très bonne soirée. Et je vous rappelle que demain matin, ça reprend avec le thème 3 à 9h30, juste pour l'indiquer. J'ai vu ça. Donc, une bonne soirée à tous. Merci.